Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Peace in the Dark, Faithful Practices as We Wait for the Light, by Jessica Herberger, narrated by Anne Richardson. Preface. Having spent much time studying Holy Week over these past years, I knew this day was coming. Saturday. With friends, family, and colleagues, I would share the thoughts and revelations I had about Thursday, the Last Supper and Break Bread Together, Friday, Good Friday and Life Surrendered, and even Sunday, more to come there. But there was a gap in the middle. What about the Saturday book? The question of whether or not to tackle it lingered, and if I did, what would the book be about? After all, the day of Holy Saturday is barely mentioned in the Gospels. It seems an afterthought to even acknowledge it. How could that be? If it is true, and I believe it is, that every moment of those days matters greatly, what are we to do with the big empty spot called Saturday? After almost a year in deep study and reflection, I have landed in a new place. Holy Saturday is not a blank space holding up the bookends of Good Friday and Easter Sunday, nor is it something that can be ignored. For believers, a good majority of our lives are actually spent living in Holy Saturday. The time after Good Friday, but before Easter Sunday, is one of the most overlooked portions of the Bible. Most of us rush ahead to the empty tomb, seeking to find the resurrected Lord. But our lives don't come equipped with a fast-forward button. We all face seasons of waiting and longing for a new or better future, dead to self, awaiting glory. Ronald Rollheiser, in his breathtaking masterpiece, Sacred Fire, says, "As adult Christians today, we often find ourselves living in that time between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. That is to say, Holy Saturday is not an afterthought at all. Holy Saturday represents the day-to-day living out of what we believe. What do we do as we wait for resurrection? Holy Saturday is the answer. Perhaps you are in Holy Saturday at this very moment. If not now, you have been before, and you will be again, and it's not the easiest place to be. Holy Saturday is what I call the time when we are waiting on God. Perhaps there has been grief, trauma, disappointment, the death of a dream, and things are not as they are supposed to be. Yet we must carry on living. The time after a tragedy, a missed opportunity, a bad decision, or a disappointment lands us in Holy Saturday. The times after a death, or the death of a dream, or the death of a relationship, all land us in Holy Saturday. Our days here are spent living in a broken place, recovering from a loss or a hurt, holding on to joy and hope, longing for peace, and navigating the in-between we find ourselves in. These things, death, disappointment, grief, are the things of life. They're inescapable. A marriage ends. A family member dies. A friend betrays us. A job is lost. A dream remains unrealized. These things happen all throughout our lives. That is why we live, for the most part, in the in-between days of Holy Saturday, again and again and again. What, at first glance, seems like an empty day is filled with wisdom beyond our imagination. On Holy Saturday, we see space for grieving and lament, for faithfulness and hope. Lessons are passed on through the generations. Best of all, we find peace in the practices of Holy Saturday. The day itself appears empty, yet it is full. It is a paradox, as all of Holy Saturday is. This makes sense because following Jesus is, after all, welcoming paradox after paradox into our lives. Up is down, the last are first, there is light in darkness. And it is all there on Saturday. As it happens, my favorite place on Earth is called Paradox. It is a small 896-acre lake in the Adirondack Park of upstate New York, just about 5 miles long and 1 mile wide. Paradox is my place of greatest peace, where I lived out the practices of Holy Saturday, even when I didn't know what to call them yet. When things have been darkest, and I'll share more of my story in the chapters to come, I have found surpassing comfort there. Paradox has been a steadfast and faithful place for me. Through 15 years of trial upon trial, this lake stands as my solace and haven. My family has a camp on Paradox, surrounded by mountains, and it is where I most love to be. The Native Americans that inhabited this land, long before I did, called it the place where water runs backward. Typically, a lake has both an outlet and an inlet. The inlet is where water comes into the lake. The outlet is where the water flows out. Most of the time, the outlet is a neighboring stream or river. For our lake, the outlet is the nearby Scroon River, which is connected to another lake, eventually connecting to the Hudson River. Water makes its way south-south-south from the Adirondack Park through this network of lakes and rivers and ends up, much like our loons, in the ocean. On most days, the water from our lake feeds into the Scroon River, following the predictable flow southward in the most unnoticeable of ways. But sometimes, when there is a great influx of rain or some sudden increase, the water in the Scroon River meets the water at our lake's outlet and overwhelms the usual flow. The water that was heading out of the lake gets pushed back in. The outlet, or exit, becomes an inlet, or entrance, and rather than draining, the lake water swells. This unusual moment when the water runs backward is our paradox, and that's how the lake got its name. The lake is a most precious place to me, one I tend to hold tight to my chest. Only the closest and most special people are invited in to share this space. So you can imagine how surprised I was when, on the last paddle of the season this past fall, I realized that I was going to be sharing this place with you, dear listener. Out in the kayak, a few research books for this project tucked in by my feet, the word paradox was ringing in my head. As I drifted about on the smooth surface of the lake, I realized I was quite literally surrounded by paradox. At that moment, story after story played in my mind, all taking place at this beloved haven of mine. And I knew I was being asked to share this place in the chapters of this book. So, dear listener, as you face your Holy Saturdays, I offer you a warm welcome and invite you to meet my paradox. I promise to share her as generously as I can, as God has used her prominently in my life. May you find peace in the dark and a haven of your own as you get to know mine. Part 1. Chapter 1. Acknowledge where you are. The women who had come with him from Galilee followed along and observed the tomb and how his body was placed. Luke chapter 23, verse 55. I have a pretty keen sense of direction, and can often find my way, even in unfamiliar cities, to my destination. I can draw a map in my mind and chart a course. I can figure out the best parking option and how to get back home again. I tend to not just draw a map in my mind, but also know my location on that map. However, this has nothing to do with the type of knowing where you are and acknowledging it that I want to discuss here. In this case, to know where you are means you understand the specific place in time you inhabit and what circumstances led you there. This is a far more difficult task than knowing the direction to drive your car. To know where you are requires an ability to look around and acknowledge, this is really happening. When tragedy strikes, this proves to be quite difficult. When we spend time in an ICU or a hospice wing, or even at the lowest point of an argument with one we love, we naturally experience a response of disbelief. This can't be happening. Acknowledging where you are says, yes, yes it is, this is happening. And it is the crucial first step as we sort out what to do, how to respond, and how to live. It is also the way Holy Saturday begins. The women who followed along to the tomb were the last people we saw on Good Friday, and they are the first ones we see on Easter Sunday. The women ended Good Friday boldly facing the tomb. Nicodemus had left. Joseph had rolled the stone in place and headed home. But Matthew chapter 27, verse 61 tells us, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were seated there, facing the tomb. They faced reality. Jesus had died and was buried. They bravely acknowledged where they were. Rather than turning away in horror or overwhelm or shame or fear, they stayed. And in staying, they were grounded in a reality that left no room for disbelief. I wonder what it was like for those women as they sat looking at the tomb. I imagine silent tears falling and a hand reached out in comfort as they observed. Luke chapter 23, verse 55 notes that the women followed along and observed the tomb and how his body was placed. Observing is something Mary did throughout her life as she found herself in unbelievable realities. To observe is to take notice. She remained present. On the night of Jesus' birth, all who heard what the shepherds reported were amazed, but Mary's response was to treasure up everything in her heart and meditate. Luke chapter 2, verses 17 through 19. Mary let it sink in. When they went to the temple for Jesus' circumcision and met Simeon and Anna, Mary heard unbelievable prophecies spoken over her son. Luke chapter 2, verses 25 through 38. And she was steady. There was no denial, no minimizing. After a trip to Jerusalem for Passover when Jesus was only 12, his parents could not find him. When Mary and Joseph made their way back to the temple, we are told that all who heard Jesus teach were astounded at his understanding. Luke chapter 2, verse 47. All that is but Mary. She was steady, she did not look away, and she kept all these things in her heart. Luke chapter 2, verse 51. That is to say, she pondered it all. Even at the edge of his death, she stood steady. John chapter 19, verse 25 says, Mary was standing by the cross. She did not waver. She was present. And now, at the end of his life, staring at the tomb, Mary's response was the same. She observed and held in her heart all that was happening. Rollheiser says to ponder is to hold, carry, and transform tension, so as not to give it back in kind, knowing that whatever energies we do not transform, we will transmit. By this definition, Mary does not look away from the mysterious or tragic, and instead holds it in her heart so that some good may come out of it. This is more than simply accepting reality. Treasuring, pondering, observing, believing. Rollheiser continues, it is a movement toward the only rays of light, love, and faith that still exist. And it is from that posture that the women stood up and began the next day. Taking stock of your actual life, whether in a moment of tragedy or mediocrity, takes courage. The world makes it very easy to distract ourselves into disorientation. The barrage of information, the pace of our lives, The fullness of our schedules leaves us running ragged and entirely unaware of where we actually are. In her book, A Curious Faith, Lore Ferguson Wilbert traces the questions God asks us and the questions we ask Him. The book begins with the first question asked of people by God, "Where are you?" In the garden, God asked Adam and Eve, in response to their hiding after the fall, "Where are you?" Genesis chapter 3, verse 9. The question may seem geographical, but the question God was asking pointed to something bigger than just their actual location. What happened? What are you going through? Where are you? Adam offers a clunky answer. He says he hid out of fear, but that doesn't actually answer the question at hand, does it? God presses in to get to the answers He is actually seeking, the answers that help root us. Questions like, "Where are you?" and "How did you get here?" cause self-reflection and require deep honesty. Yet Adam and Eve flounder, offering menial answers to these profound questions. That is to say, the task of acknowledging where we are is something we have struggled with from the very beginning. Having the ability to know and articulate where we are requires acknowledgement and awareness that slips through our fingers unless we pause to truly absorb what has happened to lead us to our exact moment. Right now, I am in my tiny writing office, so small I can almost touch opposite walls if I stretch my arms wide. 3 white walls, 1 black. I am sitting in a slightly broken office chair in front of a vintage desk we received from Josh's grandmother. This room used to be my daughter's nursery, and before that it was my mother's dressing room. There is a small window to my right that looks out into the branches of the towering pines in our yard. Around me are stacks and stacks and stacks of books and notes and scraps of paper. In the corner opposite my desk is a favorite rattan chair that I curl up in when I need a break from the desk. It is a precious little space, but all that is simply location. Where am I? Well, that is a different story. I am exhausted. I am worn out after a month of heaviness in my family's life. Yet also I am sitting in a faith that has stood and a marriage that still stands after a span of more than 15 years of crisis and stress and trial. I am pretty amazed at that. And as I look around, I realize that I think where I am, today at least, is normal life. And normal life still feels foreign to me. What is so interesting is that if I didn't look up and acknowledge where I am, I would have a hard time noticing that where I currently am is simply normal life. It is hard to identify until we actually look. The same can be said of those times when we are in crisis. When the unthinkable happens and we need to figure out what to do next, the first step is to acknowledge where we are. My mom is sick. I lost my job. My kids are not thriving. I lost a friendship. Whatever it may be. Acknowledging it is key. That is, facing it, like the women at the tomb. Most of the time when we feel lost or have lost our bearings, it is because we haven't looked around and acknowledged where we actually are. This is the paradox of feeling that we are floundering, of not knowing what we are to do. Most often the floundering dissipates when we pause and allow our souls to catch up with our reality. This is the paradox. We think we are lost when really we just haven't taken stock of where we are. We need to begin where we are, and that requires acknowledgement of where we are. So I ask you, where are you? Because of the way my losses occurred and because of my inability to completely acknowledge them in a way that allowed me to become grounded in the reality of that loss, I found myself floundering in my grief. In rapid-fire style over the course of 24 months or so, giving us hardly a moment to catch our breath, never mind get our bearings, I suffered a miscarriage on the verge of the second trimester of my first pregnancy, nursed my mom through a 13-month cancer battle, followed by her death, and then almost immediately gave birth to our son. All this while caring for my teenage brother, facing the same losses, getting him graduated from high school and off to college, providing full-time care for my brain-injured and non-independent stepdad, and for good measure, helping my maternal grandmother, who needed to get sober and into an assisted living facility. It was busy. And when I say we didn't know where we were most of the time, well, you can tell why. The morning of the one-year anniversary of my mom's passing found me gutted. My son's first birthday was just a day or two away, and I found myself shocked that my mom wasn't going to be there. Shocked! Thoughts kept swirling in my head, screaming, I can't believe she is going to miss his first birthday. I can't believe all she has already missed. I can't believe this is the story. I can't believe. Part of this is the natural course of grief, but even more so, I was floundering because I had not allowed myself the time to take in where I was when she died. Her illness was a rapid 13 months of crisis after crisis. Her death was followed very swiftly by the birth of our son, then settling my brother into college, then caring for my dad. The busyness felt like a blessing. I had something to do and someone to serve at all times. But the problem was, all that busyness kept me from looking up and acknowledging fully where I was. I did not allow myself to see, and because of that, the life I was called to live out felt unbelievable. Subsequently, I was lost. I longed for the light but didn't know how to get there, mainly because I was so shocked by the darkness. I had not been given, nor did I seek out, time to absorb, to ponder where I was. For the women of Holy Saturday, their peace was rooted in the steadfastness found not just in their proximity to Jesus, which they refused to abdicate, but also in their willingness and ability to acknowledge the tragedy that unfolded before their eyes. And this enabled them to face what must come next with peace. This is how we get through our Holy Saturdays, too. We reject busyness and distraction, and we give ourselves the gift of acknowledging where we are. It took someone finding me the morning of that anniversary, holding my shoulders, looking into my eyes, and truly asking how I was, where I was, to help me name my reality. Finally, I acknowledged how hard and brutal the last 2 years had been. I named what was going on with me. It was the beginning of my healing. No longer did I feel lost. Instead, there was finally peace. This kind of peace carries on not despite the grief, but alongside it. And it all starts with acknowledging where we are. We must say it out loud. It's been 14 years since that May. And still, this practice is needed in my life. Even in these less turbulent times, I find I can be easily disoriented. The best way to root myself in peace is to start by asking myself, where are you? The busyness creeps in, the pace quickens, and we get lost so easily. The way out begins with acknowledging where we are. Peace in the dark. As is the case of many northern lakes, every year Paradox is the home to a pair or two of common loons. To call these birds common is itself a paradox. They are fascinating creatures. Here are just a few of the unique qualities of the common loon. Both male and female have the same coloration. They mate for very long seasons, 5 years or longer. They migrate south to the warmer ocean water each winter and then return to their lake again and again. And most fascinating of all, is that the partners separate as they migrate south and then reunite each early spring at their lake. As a loon settles into its familiar water and shore, it begins to seek and wait for its partner. This is where the most haunting of the loon calls, the wail, originates. The wail is a song sung into the darkness that says, "I am here, where are you?" While nothing can compare to the experience of hearing a loon wail echo across a mountain lake, if you have never heard this hauntingly beautiful sound, it is worth a listen online. When I am at the lake in the early months of spring, the wail has a weight to it that communicates the hope and longing of the waiting loon. Where are you? Did you make it through the winter? How was the ocean? Are you on your way back to me? I am here. Where are you? The location call, just as it was in the garden, is more than a geographical question. It is a health check. Are you okay? What happened? How did you get here? This is how the loons begin their season at the lake, settling in to where they are and asking of each other, "Where are you?" As it happens, I too am grounded by their call out into the dark. I sit on our screen porch, settled into the camp chair that is older than I am, and when I hear the loon call, I exhale. The sweetest sound is the loon mate's answering wail as they finally find each other. You can hear the calls back and forth to each other as the distance between the two closes. "I am here, where are you? I am here, where are you?" The loons use this call throughout the season to let their partner know where they are on the lake. One stays with the nest, one goes out to hunt, and all the time they check in with themselves and with each other using that beautiful wail. I think this is the call to each of us as we walk out these in-between hours and days and years, a call to be constantly checking in with ourselves and then with those around us, acknowledging where we are and how we got here. My mom has been gone for 15 years now. I said to a friend recently, "All my stories lead to dead parents." For a long time, I denied that or resented it, but it is true. And while it may not be the entirety of my story, it is my story. It is the reality I bring to all places. Acknowledging it gives me peace. Fighting it leaves me floundering. Every day we rise and begin again, and as the loon calls out to another, I say to you, "I am here. Where are you?" Chapter 2. Remember. But he told him, "If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be persuaded if someone rises from the dead." Luke chapter 16, verse 31. When I arrive at the lake, the same events occur every time. I back my car into the parking spot, unsure of exactly how close I can get the car to ease unloading while making sure to leave enough space between my tailgate and the front deck. After more than 40 years of coming here, 25 of them driving my own car, I still don't remember how close to get. After the car is parked, I scramble out of the car and up the stairs, fling open the screen door, and place my hand on the worn-down brass knob of the front door. And then I pause. After just a moment passes, I open the door, and it hits me. The smell of pine. It comes at me like a puff of smoke, like a warm hug, like all my memories wrapped up and running toward me. It is a sacred moment every time. When pressed, I would tell you that is easily my favorite scent. Yet even as I describe it here, the scent eludes me. I think that moment of opening the cabin door and being welcomed by that pleasant aroma is so monumental to me because I forget to remember it until I am there with my hand on that old doorknob. It can be that way with so many things, can't it? It's not that we forget what is important. We forget to remember.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?